Hey, everybody, thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Preacher Boys podcast. I make this show for you, and I hope that you really enjoy it. I have a lot of people that ask me how they can support the show financially, and you can do that by heading over to patreon.com/preacherboys. You're going to get access to exclusive content, including early releases of episodes. I've got a couple episodes right now that have been released at least a month early over on Patreon. You've got access to things like unique merch, depending on what tier you join, and you get access to some behind the scenes content that I'm posting within the group. So head over to patreon.com/preacherboys and become a member over there today. Every single supporter helps make this show a little bit more possible, especially as I continue to add additional episodes and content every single week. Thank you so much for tuning in. Let's get back to the show.
Tonight, as far as I'm concerned, we have the choices of God's men. And Piney Heights Baptist Church, friends, we're standing tonight in royalty. We have tonight, as far as I'm concerned, a man that God's raised up, and a man that I admire and I thank God for. I listen to him. I've listened to his tapes, cry and weep, shout and praise the Lord. Brother Roloff, it's a joy to have you at Piney Heights Baptist Church tonight. Come on.
May I say in the beginning of the service tonight that it's our desire, and it will be done, to double completely. We have between 400 and 500 young people that are terminal cases. All of them have to go to the intensive care ward, and that's all we operate. We take what nobody else will take. We take what no licensed home will take. And we have between 400 and 500, and that's about the limit. And the Lord willing, and he is, we'll double this year. And we'll have, at the end of the year, either 800 to 1,000. You'd say, where are you going to get them? We get 50 calls a day, and have. We've turned, since you saw me 1 year ago today, wherever we might have been in this area, we've turned over 15,000 away. There's only one place for them to go. That's back to the street, to the cemetery, or to the prison house. And so, Brother Pastor, though I did not ask you to make a pledge, I never have, never will. But when a pastor leads his people to do such a noble deed, my heart rejoices, and I'm glad to be among some of our most faithful stockholders. And we're calling a stockholders meeting tonight, and we brought a few of the dividends along with us.
Roloff Enterprises operated numerous troubled teen homes as a tax-exempt religious organization. In 1996, the New York Times reported an annual intake of $2.5 million. Despite allegations of starvation, beatings, and isolating students, Roloff homes still exist across the United States.
Trigger warning. This podcast contains descriptions of various abusive situations. Listener discretion is advised. You are listening to the Preacher Boys podcast, a podcast shedding light on decades of mental, physical, and sexual abuse within the independent fundamental Baptist movement. The testimonies shared on this podcast are told from the personal experience and perspective of the survivors. Not all legal outcomes are known or final. Any suspect is presumed innocent until proven guilty in the court of law. To find more information about the Preacher Boys podcast and upcoming documentary, visit PreacherBoysDoc.com or connect on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the handle @PreacherBoysDoc. Now, here is your host, Eric Skwarzynski.
All right, hey everybody, welcome back to the Preacher Boys podcast. Today I'm joined by Brittany Campbell. We're going to be talking about the New Beginnings Girls Academy. Brittany, can you just introduce yourself to our audience and let them know a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, so as you said, Brittany Campbell. I was, I guess, detained. I never have really figured out a good way to say that, but I was at the Rebecca Home for Girls, which changed to New Beginnings Girls Academy while I was in it. I was there for 4.5 years. From 2001 to 2005.
Okay. And what was kind of your introduction to that home? About what time period in your age range were you in when you first went? And then what was kind of the reasoning for why you ended up at the home?
I pretty much just had like a really tumultuous childhood, was in and out of foster cares, living with different relatives and things. My dad went to prison when I was 8 years old, so just kind of like a really fractured family. And my older sister actually wound up getting legal guardianship of me when I was about 13, 14.
Okay.
And when that happened, it just sort of coincided with her being, I guess, like discipled by some IFB people. So that was how IFB came into my family's frame. Prior to that, we were just kind of casually Christian.
Like Christmas and Easter.
Just kind of non-denominational, definitely not regular churchgoers or anything. And so as she was kind of changing her lifestyle to fit the IFB lifestyle and that of her new friends and church members, there was like mounting pressure to also convert me to all of this stuff as an early teenager. So.
Right. What was your kind of response when you were approached with this? Like, she's making all these big changes. She's trying to push you to make these changes. Like, what was your reaction to that pressure?
Well, honestly, prior to that, just kind of as I mentioned, I had a pretty tough home life. My sister was 10 years older than me, but she was like my best friend my whole life. And I didn't really see the changes that she was making to her lifestyle and stuff as positive at all. She wasn't even the same person, like on any level. So it was difficult for me because I felt like I lost my best friend and just had no idea what happened to my sister. And it was just such a dramatic change and just kind of unbelievable to me. So I was very, very rebellious against it. It wasn't something that I understood at all. Yeah.
Right. So was it kind of that tension between the two of you because of that led to her sending you, or was there a specific incident, or was it just she felt like that was the only way or like a last chance to kind of, I guess, convert you to her way of thinking?
Yeah, I think there was a lot of pressure because of that, like our completely opposing belief systems. But I also think there was a lot of pressure from her church people. At the time that I moved in with her, I attended public school, and pretty much no IFB kids go to public school. It's very rare. And also around the same time, I was, you know, hitting puberty and figuring myself out. And she had found notes from friends of mine at school and stuff like that, that she basically wound up finding out that I was queer. And, you know, in an angry argument, that was how I came out. So kind of because of my upbringing and stuff, I had probably already pre-existing PTSD from my younger years also coming out and really not wanting anything to do with this. You know, to me, it was a really negative, really shocking religious movement that just sort of swooped up my older sister.
Obviously, at this time period, New Beginnings wasn't New Beginnings yet. It was the Rebecca Home for Girls in Texas. Where were you living at the time?
When I first moved in with my older sister, I had been living with my mom in Western Washington in the Seattle area. And my older sister lived in a really isolated area in northern Idaho. So, when she got guardianship of me, I was in a small town in northern Idaho, just kind of, you know, reeling at all these weird changes.
Right. So tell me a little bit about the conversation of, hey, this is where you're headed. This is the, you know, this is what I have planned out for you, you know, and how that conversation went and, you know, how you, you know, ended up traveling out to that area.
Well, there wasn't really any conversation about it. One day I came home from school and my sister and her IFB husband, they asked me if I wanted to go with them to run some errands, and I didn't know anything was amiss, so I went along with it, got in the back of their two-door car, you know, and they started heading for Texas. And
wow, okay.
Yeah.
So it's pretty much a sneak attack kind of thing with that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So how long did it take in the car before you realized, like, oh, we're not just running errands? And what was your, did you start asking questions? Did you just stay quiet and see what was happening? Did you, you know, panic? Like, what was the emotion when you realized what was going on?
I pretty much completely panicked after maybe about an hour in the car. I had started asking questions about where we were going, and sorry if my voice is kind of shaky. I'm like, it's still hard for me to talk about it after all this time. So yeah, I had started asking questions about where we were going. Obviously we weren't running errands. We're, you know, heading off on this highway into Montana. And it was kind of strange because I actually got really drowsy just out of nowhere. And I'd had some food that they gave to me when I first got in the car. So I got super drowsy and fell asleep. And like right in the middle of being like really confused and questioning everything. So it was strange. And I didn't wake up till about 8 hours later. And Wow. Yeah, at which time they let me know that they were taking me to this really strict girls' home in Texas. And they had drugs, you know, like muscle relaxers and whatever else to just kind of zonk me out if I was going to be on the ride, which I assume is, you know, they drugged me in the first place in the car. So,
Right. And
they pretty much, I started to yell at them, and I was honestly terrified. I wanted to be able to call my mom or any other family member, you know, because the rest of my family was not IFB. Like, they wouldn't have been in agreement with this whole process. But my sister was my legal guardian now, so there was just nothing that I could do.
Right.
And they pretty much told me that if I didn't calm down with yelling at them and demanding to talk to somebody or get out of the car, then they were going to both drug me and shackle me. And like they had shackles in the car that they threatened to restrain me with. So it was intense,
right,
to say the least.
Right. So about what time did you actually arrive at the home? And what was kind of the process kind of entering the home, you know, meeting the staff and like that process? Because I can't imagine those circumstances, then getting out of the car and then just being a normal, like, oh, hey, I'm here kind of situation.
Being a friendly time. Yeah. Well, I believe the car trip took about 40 hours or so. I wound up complying with taking whatever type of pills they had that they gave to me, and pretty much just was passed out the entire car ride. And we arrived in Corpus Christi, Texas, and stopped at a rest stop just outside of town. And I was like a goth kid and stuff. So they took my, you know, crazy clothes and made me change into some more tame ones before going to the home. And I was just kind of shocked because I left North Idaho in the middle of January. It's snowy and frozen, and we get down to Texas and it's just this completely different climate, totally different culture and whatnot. And when we got to the home, back when this was the Rebecca Home for Girls original, like, roll-off home, the girls' dorm was situated on like 700 acres of People's Baptist Church property. And it was this massive dorm that could potentially house like hundreds of girls. And so when we strolled up, you know, like drove up to it, we had to go past like a guard shack. It looked like a prison, basically.
Right.
I have photos too that I could give to you about.
Okay, perfect.
But yeah, so that was pretty alarming. It was just like we're pulling up to some, you know, South Texas like institution of some kind.
Right.
But yeah, when I walked inside with them, the first thing that I noticed was just that you could hear like a pin drop in there. There was like no sound. And if there were supposed to be all of these girls there, it was kind of scary that it was so quiet. And yeah, they took me into the office and kind of started the whole process of telling me how things were going to be.
How did they explain how things were going to be? Was it just like, you know, it was strict? Did they, you know, did they give you your clear day-to-day schedule, or did you feel like it was just pretty generic until you actually started the process of being there?
It seemed kind of like while my sister and brother-in-law were still there, it was like a really quick, hurried, like, okay, we'll see you later, you know. And I'm in the office with Bill McNamara and one of his staff members. It seemed like while they were still there, it was a really friendly, like, we're just going to love you and take care of you and all of this stuff, and we'll fix these problems that you have or whatever. Mm. And then just like from the moment that they left, it was completely different. Like,
right.
what they did was like, they took any belongings that I had that were not approved, and, you know, gave me clothes that I had never seen clothes like that before, except for at my sister's church and stuff, and made me shower. And then they introduced me to Buddy, which was a girl who had been there for a while. She was a trusted girl, and she was supposed to follow me around and show me the ropes, I guess. So once I went with my buddy and kind of parted from the staff in the office, she took me into one of the rooms there, and she showed me, like, the inside of the closet door had four pieces of paper on it that detailed what the rules were like there. And the first thing that I noticed was, like, at the very top in, like, big bold letters, it was no talking. And
right.
And I can remember asking her about that, like, what does that mean? And it's just very literally, you cannot speak, like, yeah, while you are here, you can't speak.
Right.
I think with a lot of the interviews about the girls' home or various homes for teens, sometimes that gets kind of glazed over because we were so used to that. But it was like what everything revolved around was, like, complete silence. You weren't allowed to communicate with each other. You weren't allowed to speak.
Right. I had one guest. I'm trying to remember who it was. I'm trying to remember if it's one I just did or if it's one that just got released, but someone talked about that, like, it was with Abby Jameson. I just released that interview, mm-hmm, and it was, yeah, with Marvelous Grace Girls Academy. She talks about being an extroverted, you know, I mean, essentially an extroverted teenage girl that was talkative, and, you know, the same way I was an extroverted teenage boy. Like, there's certain, yeah, people's personality is to talk and communicate. And, you know, it's when you have all of those, especially when you're in that time period of your life where you are developing and you are developing ideas and learning, mm-hmm, like, to not be able to communicate or talk is a huge, like, just from a developmental level, like, that can't be good for you. Even if it's not your personality, like, to not be able to say anything, or to, you know, to not know who is the person I'm sharing a bunk bed with, or who is, you know, I do want to ask a staff member what's going on, or I do, mm-hmm, you know, and it's a big way. Like, I just talked with someone from Agape boarding school, and he says, you know, you're going to have fights when there's, you know, there's two people that can't talk, can't communicate. There's no way to, you know, release any of your feelings or emotions. If you bump into somebody the wrong way, you're going to have a fight. You're, mm-hmm, you're creating an environment where it's going to create nothing but negative thought, whether that's, yeah, internal or if it, you know, leaks into the external. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it is definitely a huge deal.
Yeah. And anytime that I've written about my experience there online and stuff, I've kind of always come back to that. Like, I think that was really impactful to my development. Like, I still struggle. Like, anytime that I've had jobs and things like that, communication is, like, really difficult for me, you know?
Right. Yeah. So what did a day in the life of you as a student there look like? So when you woke up in the morning, you know, what was it? What was the layout of the day? What was the schedule generally for a day?
So usually waking up happened around 5 a.m. Pretty much every day was pretty much exactly the same. There was not a lot of focus on, like, academics as much as, you know, with their brochures and websites and whatnot, they kind of tried to advertise it as that. But most of the focus was on Bible memorization at New Beginnings and Rebecca, memorizing large sections of the Bible, like, so that we could just rattle stuff off for, like, 1 to 2 hours. And then secondly, huge emphasis on singing performances. So we just, like, practice singing constantly, like, multiple hours, you know, a week. And the reason for that was because that was sort of a big source of their income. They would tour us around to different churches at different points throughout the year, and then over the entire summer kind of parade us around to different churches, have us do singing performances and talk about, like, what bad kids we were before, you know, right, Rebecca or New Beginnings, and at the end pass the offering plate, and, you know, just every single day of the summer.
Right.
And for us, it was agonizing. You know, we would give these performances and stuff, but like you can even see it in the, I guess, like the YouTube videos of New Beginnings singing performances, all the girls have their down. And that's because that was like one of the rules, like on these singing tours, we were super sleep deprived, like ridiculously sleep deprived, overworked, you know, sometimes physically abused during these tours, and we'd have to go up there and deliver just these moving performances.
We have several testimonies. I tell you, the Lord's been good to us. We thank you, Lord. Thank the Lord for y'all letting us be here, and then the Oneida guest house over there, what a blessing, and putting all the kids up down here and feeding us. And believe me, I know what it costs to feed the bunch. I mean, I cannot believe the hamburger, 20 pounds of hamburger, or not out. It used to be 30 pounds of hamburger at one meal. Hey, you know how much hamburger is? Amen. It's high, isn't it? Yeah, we try 30 pounds, praise God. Yeah. Amen. Yeah. But you say you complain, Brother Mac? Not at all. We got more than we need, probably. We got plenty. I tell you, Lord's been good to us. Amen. And the Brother Dilbert's got to see the place out there, and it's just a blessing. And that was a miracle how that took place. And he's just been good to us. Amen. And no complaints, but let's have a little bit of singing, and then we'll testify just a little bit, all right?
Psalm 48, 1 and 2. Great is the Lord, and greatly to be praised, in the city of our God, in the mountain of his holiness. Beautiful for situation, the joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion, on the sides of the north, the city of the great king. Yeah. I was in a valley.
When you say physically abused on these tours, do you mean like spankings? Do you mean like restraints? Like what does that entail?
Honestly, I was actually speaking to a former New Beginnings students earlier about that. Because I noticed that one of the interviews that you did recently, I think it was actually Abby, she had mentioned like that it was mostly mental abuse and stuff. But I think that sometimes the day-to-day life in these places, you get so used to it that you don't really acknowledge that, like, making you stand up with your face to a wall for hours at a time in stress positions, that's physical abuse. Like, they would do, like, different types of super painful exercise sessions where, you know, there would be girls just crying and, you know, fainting and... But yeah, there was also corporal punishment with restraints and beatings. Yeah, like,
right.
I don't even want to call it spankings. That's not what happened.
Right. Yeah, no. I watched a clip. I actually just pulled it up. I'll probably insert it into the actual edit of the interview. But there's a video that I've used clips from before where it's presenting a church, and you can just feel a lack of energy and excitement from the people that are up there. Like it's I mean, it's palpable. Like there's a very clear sense of like, they're tired, don't want to be there, you know, and are being forced to do this performance. Like if you're watching it with no context, it would almost be funny. Like it's this very monotone reading of, you know, these verses. Mm-hmm. It's singing these songs with this very robotic kind of gesturing. And it's like, but then when you start thinking about these interviews or you start thinking about the stories, it's not really funny. It's more sad because you're seeing people who, you know, I've had people on before, you're sleeping in the auditorium of a church the night before and then, you know, eating something from like homeless shelter or, you know, donated food. And then you're getting up and then you're essentially raising money for, I mean, McNamara and for, you know, you're not raising money that's going to help you. You're not getting money for touring. Like you know what I mean? Like it's a really sad clip to watch. Yeah. So that was every summer? Was that just all throughout the summer you would travel? Mm-hmm. Was that across the whole U.S. or within that circle? Or
For the most part, it was like the south eastern U.S.
Like
but
the Bible Belt, basically, like that kind of like Texas and, you know, venturing
out
that one.
We did kind of venture out of that somewhat. Like I think the furthest north we ever went was like Delaware on the East Coast. We're all over the place.
Okay. Got it. So you're at the Rebecca Home for Girls, and eventually that was shut down. So Was there anything else there that you want to cover before we move over, or is that what was the time span there? Because I know you were in several different variations of this. So what was the time span of Rebecca versus the latter homes?
So I was there in 2001 when it was still in Texas. The Rebecca home had only actually reopened in 1999 after years of being closed for abuse allegations. So they reopened in 1999 and by 2001 were already closed down again by the states, by the state.
So you were there for about 2 years and then?
I was actually there just in 2001. So it was like,
oh, just in 2001. Okay.
9 months or so.
Okay. So what happened when they shut down? Did you go home for a small period or was it shut down and then you just got in the van and went to the next spot?
Well, I think what happened was, I believe that the reason that the home was closed was because of a situation that had happened with a girl. There have been numerous articles written about where she was restrained and put in an isolation room and then kicked in the ribs, slapped in the face, and all of these things occurred to her. I could send you a link for that article. But I believe for some reason, even after all of that, obviously these claims were substantiated. The state gave the program like a certain amount of time to have everybody out and sent home by. So I believe that that was supposed to happen by like September or so of 2001.
Right.
And they told us about it in June or so of 2001.
Told you that you were going to be going home soon.
Yeah, they pretty much, it was like an announcement. They called us all to the living area where all of us could fit. And at the time, there were 95 to 100 girls there. And basically, Bill McNamara stood up and said, the home's being shut down. You guys are, most of you are going to go home. And that was pretty much all that we knew. And then over the course of the next few months, there were students who would get a visit from their parents and then just go home. So it was like that number of almost 100 girls like went down to about 40 girls over the next couple of months. And okay. I was one of the lucky ones that got to stay. So,
right. So the transition out of Rebecca to Missouri, to New Beginnings in Missouri, you were actually, if I understand from what we were saying earlier, it was connected to another existing girls' home. So you basically kind of just combined into two homes into one for a short period. So how long were you guys there? And then what changes did you see in the program during that time period, if any, or did it stay pretty much the same?
I would say it stayed pretty much the same. Maybe got even a little worse, a little tougher. But yeah, so we went up to this small town called Devil's Elbow, Missouri. And at the time, there was a boys' home there called Thanks to Calvary.
Right.
And it was sort of, as I understand it, it was sort of a spinoff of Mountain Park Christian Academy, for another home for teens. And we stayed with Thanks to Calvary, like in a kind of makeshift dorm. It was like a mobile home with like no walls inside of it, like basically just like an empty mobile home with bunk beds in it. And we stayed there for probably, I want to say, like a couple of months.
Okay. So very quick there, relatively. And so you're about what age during this time?
At that time, I would have been about 16.
Okay. So around this time, so you're in pretty much about a year at this point. What's your mindset at that point? Is it just, I've accepted, I'm here, keep my head down, don't make a stir? Were you kind of bucking the system, fighting what they were saying? Was there part of you that's starting to buy into what they were saying? Like, what was your mindset at that point after a year of this kind of environment?
I would say that by the time that we got to Missouri, I had kind of learned, like, you know, after being there for that long, like coming up on a year at that point, by that time I had kind of learned to just go along with things, I guess. Prior to that though, like leading up to, I guess, my will just being completely broken, I suppose is the best way to put it. Yeah. I had been on a punishment called Red Shirt, which a lot of people have talked about. And basically, they didn't allow us calendars or unsupervised use of like pen and paper. So I don't actually know to this day how long I was on Red Shirt. But basically from 5 o'clock in the morning to sometimes after 11 at night, I would have to stand with my nose, the tip of my nose touching a wall for, I'm not even certain how many months daily. So it took me a really long time to get off of that. And the reason that I had been put on that punishment was just because, like, when I first got to the home, I really thought that I thought that I kind of could rebel. Like, I thought that I...
Yeah. You thought that was an option.
Yeah. Yeah, thought that was an option. I thought maybe I could be, you know, kicked out or something. But yeah, just it didn't really lead anywhere except for to, you know, red shirt. So
right. Well, I guess also because I've had mixed answers from people from these different homes, but obviously you mentioned corporal punishment, the physical punishment, humiliation, things like that. With McNamara or the staff, was there ever any sense of like sexual misconduct or like inappropriate behavior with the staff? Because I know that's something that circles, like when I see conversation about these schools, that's a topic that comes up very often. And I've heard some people that say, I never sensed that. I never saw that. I've heard, you know, had people that have said, you know, I definitely saw that, or I definitely heard, you know, there's definitely things going around about this. So mm-hmm. What did you see anything that was like that, or did you sense that while you were there?
Well, there were definitely a lot of things that were ridiculously sexually inappropriate. So after briefly staying with that home, thanks to Calvary in Missouri, we eventually wound up at Pace, Florida location.
Right.
And that was when it became New Beginnings Girls Academy. Eventually when the state of Florida put pressure on New Beginnings and they started seeing abuse allegations come in the media and all of this stuff, they closed down and went back to Missouri. And then Marvelous Grace Girls Academy opened up on that property. So in the course of all of that time, like I was with the McNamaras for, you know, 4.5 years, kind of like another person who was interviewed mentioned, I'd sort of gained a lot of trust just by being there for so long and like knowing the rules, knowing the ropes. So over that time, yeah, I did hear a lot of things about, and there was like one girl who was sent home after trying to pass one of the junior staff members a note that said that Bill McNamara had tried to engage in, like, you know, tried to basically proposition her to do sexual favors for him for an easier time there. And there was also, like, when I say like there were other super sexually inappropriate things, there was a lot of, during Bill McNamara's like preaching sessions, which it was just pretty much screaming in your face. He would say a lot of stuff about people's sexual orientation, like very graphic stuff, though. Like,
yeah, that's a comment I've heard from everybody from New Beginnings has been that. Yeah. Has been the preaching was very sexualized, which is, you know, that's not rare to IFB preaching for sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You go from Texas, you go to Missouri, and then you end up in Florida, which is where the majority of the stories seem to come out of that I've talked to so far. So now he's pretty much back to running things completely his way. You know, he's not merged with someone. He's not worried about the politics of all of that. What was that core of your stay, that time in Florida day to day? Like, did that just look like another ramped up version of it? Because it seems like you just kind of progressed from like bad to worse to worse.
Yeah. But I think that when it was the Rebecca Home for Girls back in Texas, there were a lot of other staff members involved in different ministries on that property and stuff. So
Right. When
we were eventually in Florida at New Beginnings, it was just pretty much Bill McNamara running the show. There were a couple people on paper, like evangelist Jimmy Clark and then Wiley Cameron, who was Lester Roloff's successor, basically, who were board members or, you know, in the ministry, but we barely ever saw them. So it was pretty much Bill McNamara and his wife running the show there. And yeah, it did just get worse and worse. There was a lot of physical abuse. And I guess what I mean is they basically, we weren't allowed to speak. So that's understood. Like, we couldn't talk to each other. We couldn't even non-verbally communicate with each other. And they had this sort of like sort of like a ranking system where when you're brand new, you're just lower rung, or if you're on redshirt or discipline, which they changed the name to discipline, you know, like you're a very low ranking person in that situation. But after you sort of kind of have been there for a while and you start minding your P's and Q's, like Bill McNamara would like force us to to restrain each other and like participate in the abuse against each other. So we didn't want to do that, but we also didn't want to be the girl face down in on a right. floor in the back of a church for 5 hours or whatever. Right. So,
yeah, that's an interesting kind of tactic because, you know, I know I had a guest on from one of these homes and, someone basically commented and was saying, oh, I remember they were just as bad as anyone. They were they started working with them and, but mm-hmm. even her response was, what choice do you have when you're, like it's a weird thing that keeps everybody at each other's throats while not looking at the person who's causing all of it, who's provoking that kind of thing. But I wasn't aware about them actually, forcing people to participate in the actual punishment side. I knew it was implied in a lot of the conversation, but I didn't know that it was an actual like process. So did that essentially go with the whole ranking thing too? Like the better students mm-hmm. ended up on that side. Okay.
Yeah. So it was definitely a situation like that with me. So like, as I've mentioned, didn't really have like a super strong family structure in the first place. And actually after my first year in the home, I actually got to go home for a couple of months to my sister. Place. I'm sorry, I used your name.
I can take it out.
So I went back to my sister's place in North Idaho, and I was there for a couple of months, but she didn't want to put me in public school. She didn't want to undo all of this progress, that had happened at New Beginnings. And so one day she got a phone call from Bill McNamara asking her if she might be willing to send me back to do work around the property, and they wouldn't have to pay any tuition, and like I could just, pay my own way working for my high school education, basically. And so, yeah, like as far as kind of using us as tools against each other, when I was sent back to New Beginnings, I didn't want to start all over. I didn't want to be like back on redshirt, like dealing with all those punishments and stuff. So, when they first brought up sending me back, I was just like, please don't send me back, but it became pretty clear pretty quick that my sister and brother-in-law didn't want me at home. So, I basically deduced that if I didn't, go along with going back there as a junior staff member, then I was going to go back as a new girl either way. So,
right. So what was the response of your brother-in-law and your sister when you came back originally and told them what happened there? Did they have any concern about it? Was it, like what was the reaction to hearing the stories coming from you?
So when I first went back, it was when I was 16 after that first year there, when I first went back to my family, I didn't tell them. I didn't tell them everything that had happened. I was just, after being labeled as this like troubled teen, grappling with like my sexuality and, literally being forced to adopt this entirely new identity and belief system and stuff. Right. I didn't want to risk like them doing anything worse,
Right.
So... So yeah, I didn't really say anything about the abuse when I first got sent back to my family. But when I did eventually get out at 19, that was when I came, told them everything. And, that IFB home church that had converted my sister and stuff, they didn't care. They didn't believe me at all.
So, having left, so you spent a total of... how many years then? About four.
Over four.
Five. Yeah. Four. Mm-hmm. So coming out, sharing your story, you've obviously been a part of really like speaking out against these homes. Can you talk about that process and how you went from you know, hey, you know, this happened to me. Like, there's basically two reactions. Like, you can put your head down and just go about your life, you know, or at least try to go about your life in some normal fashion, or you can do that and become, you know, an advocate for other survivors. And you've definitely leaned toward being an advocate for other people. You've been involved with other articles, and you've spoken out for people. You've been active in a lot of these survivor networks and things like that. Mm-hmm. You know, what was it that motivated you into that action? Was there a period where you thought about just like not addressing it, like pretending it never happened? Or did you kind of go instantly into that mode of, you know, I need to start sharing my story?
It was pretty much instantly. Like, when I did eventually get out of the home at 19, I had been completely cut off for so long from the rest of my family that I didn't think I had anywhere to go except for back to my sister, my IFB sister. So she was super controlling and just wanted me to get married to a Baptist guy. And so after a couple of months of kind of trying to reason with her about that, I left like in the middle of the night with the clothes on my back. And I think because of, you know, having to start from just complete and total scratch, like I had a lot of like, I don't know how to explain it. I suppose I felt really compelled to help other people who had been in these circumstances. So I called DCF, Child Protective Services and stuff right away. I think that was kind of like the spark that started them moving out of Florida and into Missouri.
Got it.
And then after that, I linked up with other survivors of New Beginnings and other homes on social media. I found out that some of these other survivors had survivor support groups. So me and a handful of girls, like just girls at the time, because there was only like the Girls Academy and I didn't know anybody else yet. But like me and a handful of former students started a support group, and there were like just a couple people in there. And then it grew up to like 250 people over time. And I've been working on this myself for about a decade, like pretty much been interviewed by like every major news source. Like, not all of them have used the info, because like we talked about before, it's a big topic for a journalist to tackle. But yeah, it basically just, it gave me like a sense of purpose. And there are a lot of female artists and stuff. I'm an artist, and a lot of female artists over time that have started organizations for survivors of abuse and things like that. And I was really inspired by them. And I also felt kind of like almost like a calling to do this, because I knew that I had so much energy and that I was articulate, you know, and my education prior to the home was pretty solid. So it was like, I knew that there were a lot of former students that could not speak out about it on the level that, you know, I was blessed to be able to, I guess.
Right. What would you say has been the most helpful? I mean, obviously the network's building healthy community, but what's been the most helpful thing for you? I mean, obviously it's not a, you know, flip a switch and the effects are all gone, but what's been most helpful for you on your day-to-day, like kind of, you know, I don't know what the right word is, recovering from being in this, like from, you know, untreating like all the negative things that you were told about yourself or about other people. Like, what's been most helpful for you on that journey? Has it been, you know, you mentioned you're an artist. Has it been like getting it out that way? Has it been through mainly the community and conversation? Like, what's been the big key there to kind of moving to the next, you know, stage of life?
I think it's been pretty multifaceted, I guess. I was in therapy for a long time. There are so many communities just online that you can that you can link up with. Like, there's a Religious Trauma Institute there. At the time of all of us kind of first being inspired to do some activism work about all this, there were several groups for survivors of institutional abuse, peer support groups for mental health issues, things like that. So I really personally just linked up with those people as much as I could. I did do conventional, you know, therapy for many years, and but yeah, like also art has been one of the biggest things that has helped me, and just trying to help other people, because if there's no other reason, you know, that all of this happened, you know, like some deep special reason that these terrible things happened to us, like, you know, at least the one thing that we can bring out of it that's positive is that we helped other people make it.
I'm just curious, is there somewhere we can see your art, or is there somewhere that you somewhere that that works out, or
I'm actually kind of I'm kind of working on some, I guess, rebranding and like setting up some new Instagram accounts and stuff like that. But I will let you know about that, I guess.
Cool. Yeah, definitely do. I mean, I'm from a creative background too, and that's been a huge way that it's different. Like I do like photography and videography and things like that, but like that's mm-hmm. always been a huge constant. So whenever someone says that, I perk up, and I'm always curious where people can see and support that kind of stuff. So, but yeah, I mean, I these are always hard conversations to start and hard conversations to end, but I appreciate you sharing your story. I see you on Facebook all the time, helping people, sharing your perspectives, encouraging other people who've been through these kind of situations. And, I can't thank you enough for doing that from, obviously the side that I'm doing stuff. And, just as someone who's seen firsthand a lot of stuff, I'm not even close to the scale that you have, but has seen a lot of negative influence within the IFB. And I really appreciate the work you've been doing and the voice that you've had, because you've been going at this even longer than I have. You've been, you've been really going out there and sharing what's happening. And I really appreciate that.
No, I appreciate everything that you're doing. And I guess I would just say to other people who have survived all of this, don't stop sharing about it, until they have, basically they have standards for housing children on par with the standards that they have for like housing animals and things like that.
Right.
Please keep speaking out and sharing.
Right. Yeah. That's huge. We were talking right before we started recording, and I was sharing with you, like, there's, I have cases, I probably have 311 cases that are, half of those are still waiting to get uploaded to the site. I've got tons of my messages. I've probably got 400 some odd cases that I still need to add that are solid. I can add them, but I've got a ton of cases where I know the person's name. I know where they live. I know their, what they were accused of. I know what there's three or four people that can all confirm it, but nobody wants to attach their name to it. And I understand that, but also, it's a tricky conversation. It's a tricky thing to think about. And I understand, I don't want someone to get involved in something where they, they're not mentally ready to talk about it or things like that. But if you've been wondering how you can help and you are ready to share your story, that could be the key to some of these guys actually getting some form of punishment, some form of, and so if somebody did want to speak out and they do want to take the steps to become an advocate and speak out against these homes, since you're a survivor yourself, you've kind of been through this road, like what would you recommend to someone who is sitting there thinking like, I want to share my story. I want to help other people, but I don't know where to even get started. What would you recommend to them?
So there are so many avenues where you can share your story these days. You can share it with obviously just your friends and family to let them know that these things go on so that they can, they can tell others too. I mean, that especially in churches, that they can have more of a watchful eye on these situations, because I do think that the biggest issue with especially abuse in the IFB is that everybody kind of tends to assume that everybody's, upstanding citizens, and it's not really how it is. A lot of these characters running things are, former convicts and whatever, who just are now saved. Yeah. And,
Right.
But you can, what we did was we started a Facebook group, linked up with other Facebook groups, and then established pages on other social media. But what we did to really get attention from the media was we started filling out reviews. So you eventually have like 80 people commenting on this company's, review page on Google or wherever. You're going to sooner or later get somebody's attention. Mm-hmm. At the very least, parents who go to look up what type of program to send their kids to, they're going to see, 80 people saying, this is abusive. Yeah. So, but even if there's not, you don't have 80 friends to do this with, like, the attention that we got that it really eventually kind of drove New Beginnings into just kind of obscurity. Like, there aren't teenagers there right now. Knowledge. We just we filled out complaints boards, Better Business Bureau stuff about them all the time. We gave kind of little testimonials on forums because those show up in the Google search results. You can create your own blog for free and you can go to protests. There's, you know, definitely all types of protests that you can join up with these days about human rights. And then other than that, I would just say to reach out to us because like the crazy amount of media contacts that we have at this point, it would just kind of blow most people away. And, you know, I'm happy to put you guys in contact with those people.
Awesome. Awesome. What is the best way for people to contact you or contact those you've worked with in the past?
Probably the best way to contact me would be to email me at, I guess the best email would be bcampbell.nbga, New Beginnings Girls Academy, @gmail.com.
Okay.
And you can also join, pretty much anybody's welcome to join the New Beginnings Survivor support group if you want help kind of being pointed in the right direction.
Right.
As a survivor of any program.
Got it. Yeah, it can be, it seems like there's people in there from any troubled, you know, teen home or, you know, troubled boys home, troubled girls home. There's a good variety in there. Mm-hmm. And then there's people like me who, you know, aren't from one of these homes, but I'm interested in exposing what's going on. So, and it's been a really helpful resource and a great way to connect with all of you. So definitely second that. So. Well, great. Well, thank you so much. Definitely get me a link to your artwork so we can promote a little bit of that in here as well, that way people can connect. But I really appreciate you coming on. I know it's going to be a huge help to people watching.
Yeah, thank you for having me and for everything you're doing.
Thank you for listening to the Preacher Boys podcast. If you appreciated the content on the show, please leave a review on iTunes and don't forget to connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the handle @PreacherBoysDoc. Additional information can always be found on PreacherBoysDoc.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound rolls of juicy 80% lean ground beef for $3.49 a pound with a digital coupon. Then get select varieties of flavorful Powerade, Body Armor Super Drink, or Arizona tea for 77 cents each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.